This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Tom Clancy, Line of Sight by Mike Madden. Read for you by Scott Brick. Chapter 1. Seven Corners, Virginia. Dr. Guzman rubbed her tired eyes. She became a doctor to heal the sick, not to file endless reports. But here she was, typing away after hours. Again. No matter. It was the price she paid to run the free clinic for the poorest of the poor in the area, mostly immigrants. She checked her watch. The delivery was late. As soon as it arrived, she'd finish up this last budget report and head home for some needed shut-eye. A noise in the back room startled her. She glanced up from her laptop, listening. Nothing. Probably just the rats again, she told herself. Gross. She made a mental note to pick up some more traps at Lowe's tomorrow on her way in. She settled back down into her spreadsheet, her bleary eyes focused on the empty columns she still needed to fill with numbers. Her fingers froze. She smelled the acrid tang of sweat and dope before she felt the blade against her throat. The man stood behind her, grabbed a fistful of her hair. "The drugs are in the safe. I can't open it," she said in Spanish, her first language. The voice behind her laughed. "Don't want the drugs, bitch," he said in English. "We gonna party." Guzman whispered a prayer and cursed her stupidity. She'd left the back door unlocked for the delivery. That meant no alarm. That's how he got in. And with no alarm, no help was on the way. The man grabbed her shoulder and spun the chair around. He stood over her, flashing a gold tooth and a nicotine-stained smile. His bare, ropey arms were slathered in tattoos, but it was his shaved skull that shocked her. His entire head, from the neckline up, was a tangle of blue ink, with MS splashed across his throat and 13 emblazoned on his forehead. She recognized him. He had come in last week, a wreck, hep C and gonorrhea. He gave a name, Lopez, but no ID. She assumed it was fake. Didn't matter. He was sick. She was a doctor. She treated him, even if he did give her the chills. But now? "You don't have to do this," she said, stealing her voice. "Don't have to. Want to." He smiled. He stepped closer, thrusting his belt buckle close to her face. He laid the blade flat against her cheek. "So do you. If you want to live." "Not like that." A soft whistle from behind. The gangbanger whipped around, pulling a chrome Ruger 357 out from beneath his shirt. Fast. A real gunslinger. But a larger hand was faster. It grabbed the 4-inch barrel and yanked it up toward the ceiling, then outward and away. Fast. But not fast enough. Tendons snapped in the banger's wrist, but his index finger smashed against the cocked trigger. A magnum round fired with a deafening roar into a ceiling tile, superheating the barrel in the big man's right hand. He didn't let go. The big man's left hand crashed into the banger's jaw, buckling his knees. He crumbled to the floor, out cold. It had all happened in a flash. Dr. Guzman didn't have time to scream, let alone help. She stared wide-eyed at the man standing in front of her now. 6'1", 190 pounds of lean muscle, black hair, blue eyes. Still in shock. All she could manage was, "Who are you?" The man tucked the Ruger into his waistband. "My sister Sally sent me. With those." He pointed at a backpack on the floor a few feet away where he had set it down. "Antibiotics. Said you were running short."
"Dr. Sally Ryan?"
"Yeah."
"Then you must be Jack Ryan."
He shrugged and smiled. "Junior." Chapter 2. Idlib, Syria. The Syrian fighter stood on the roof of the apartment building, shielding his aging eyes from the western sun as he watched the children playing in the streets 7 floors below. They sweated and laughed in the long shadows of the fading light, swarming after the ball like bees chasing a dog, ignoring the calls of their anxious mothers to come in and clean up. He smiled. "Kids everywhere. The same." The truce was a mercy.
Thanks be to God, he whispered to himself. He checked his watch, a nervous habit. By the fading light he knew the muezzin's voice would ring out over the loudspeakers, calling for the Maghrib. He had raged when his battalion commander, an Iraqi, first announced the truce with that butcher Assad and his paymasters, the godless Russians. But the last 9 weeks had given them time to rest and regroup with smuggled weapons, food, fuel, cash. Now they were ready for anything up close, and their Stinger missiles kept the dreaded Russian jets and helicopters out of the skies. The senior al-Nusra commanders were all stationed here. Even the emir was living in Idlib, just 3 blocks away. This was the safest place in Syria, as long as the truce lasted. The war seemed far away now, a distant, painful memory. So much blood. And for what? Life was better than death, was it not? He craved a cigarette, even after all these years. But cigarettes were haram, and men in his unit had been executed for smoking them. But perhaps a strong coffee after Maghrib, he thought, his eyes tracking the black-clad women scurrying into the street, clapping their hands and shouting, trying to herd the laughing children back to their homes. The Adhan began, a strong voice calling the faithful. Its familiar words warmed his soul. The mosque would be full tonight. He picked up his rifle and headed for the stairs. Perhaps the war was indeed over, and these children would finally know peace. Thanks be to God. 9 miles south of Idlib. A bead of sweat trickled down the side of Captain Walib's face, despite the AC unit blasting overhead. The Syrian captain stared at the monitor in front of him, his right hand poised near the master launch button. The monitor verified the ready state of the fire control computers on the 6 TOS-2 Starfire launch vehicles stationed nearby, each composed of a 70-tube box missile launcher fixed on a heavily armored T-14 Armata tank chassis, and all linked to his command console. He and Major Grechko sat at their stations inside the cramped BMP-3K armored personnel fighting vehicle, Walib's mobile command post. Technically, the Russian major was only an advisor on today's operation. But in reality, Grechko was evaluating Walib's combat command capabilities, along with the new TOS-2 Starfire system. Walib stole a quick glance at Lieutenant Aslan Jabrailov, sitting near the doorway. The young, broad-shouldered Chechen was the platoon leader of the commandos guarding his unit. There was a fierce intelligence in the man's pale gray eyes, and a well-used 10mm Glock on his hip. The Chechens were savage, brutal fighters. A breed apart, the best in the war, at least on his side. Jabrailov was a man to be feared. The major checked the GLONASS receiver, the Russian version of GPS, one last time, along with the laser guidance beam. Targeting confirmed. Free to fire, Captain. Walib smoothed his mustache with his thumb and forefinger, hesitating. Something wrong, Captain? Grechko asked. Walib was a Syrian patriot. He had no problem killing terrorists, especially foreign ones. The Syrian civil war was fought by everyone but Syrians these days. But they were all just proxies for the Americans and Russians, who happily sacrificed the Syrian people on the altar of their superpower ambitions. He hated them all, especially today. There are no civilians in Idlib, Captain, Grechko said. Only al-Nusra bandits, the women who breed them, and the children who become either bandits or breeders. This is a war of demographics. We must fight accordingly. This wasn't the war Walib had volunteered to fight. He never imagined the terrible weapons under his command would be used to slaughter innocents. But if he disobeyed Grechko's order, the Russian would pull his 9mm Grach pistol out of its holster and splatter his brains against the BMP's steel hull, and simply order one of Walib's lieutenants in the other vehicles to fire. Nothing would be accomplished, except that Walib would be dead in exchange for a few minutes of respite for the doomed civilians. He hated himself. He hated this war, but he hated dying needlessly even more. "Just checking the spin on the number 11 gyro," Walib said. "A convenient lie. Good to go. Then you're free to launch. Proceed at once." Gretschko's drooping bulldog eyes narrowed. "Yes, sir." Walib flipped the safety cap on the launch button and jabbed it before he could change his mind. Instantly, the French-designed solid-fuel motors on the 122-millimeter rockets fired. The roar was terrifying, like the shout of God himself, even inside the idling command vehicle. Each half-second, another 9.5-foot-long missile screamed out of its tube, a full-throated chorus of death. 35 seconds later, all 420 missiles had launched, lofting nearly 15 tons of thermobaric munitions into the air. The TOS-2 master fire control computer coordinated the launch timing and trajectories so that all of the warheads arrived on target simultaneously, avoiding warhead fratricide and increasing the explosive effects. Gretschko stared greedily at his monitor, displaying a live video feed from the Israeli-designed four-post M aerial drone circling high over Idlib, which also provided the laser guidance beam for the missiles. "Any second now," Gretschko said, grinning. "Time to burn out those cockroaches." But Walib didn't want to see it. He was already outside, barking orders to his men who were scrambling to prep for rapid shoot-and-scoot redeployment, the only defense against counter-battery fire, real or imagined. Walib marched through the billowing clouds of exhaust and debris still swirling in the air, rage and shame welling in his eyes. Lieutenant Jabrailov stood outside the command vehicle, studying the Syrian captain with keen interest. Idlib, Syria. The laser-guided TOS-2 Starfire rockets struck inside a kill box 280 meters square, about 8 densely populated city blocks. A much tighter pattern was possible with the new guidance system, but it would have resulted in far fewer casualties. The cascade of crashing warheads released clouds of combustible fuel mixed with finely powdered aluminum, PETN high explosive, and ethylene oxide gas into the open streets. The incendiary clouds also penetrated through the cracks and crevices of nearly every mosque, apartment building, and shop in the 8-block area. Basements, attics, kitchens, toilets, and bedrooms filled with the toxic mixture in nanoseconds, leaving nowhere to hide. Timed scatter charges of conventional explosives within the warheads detonated next, igniting the explosive fog into a blazing plasma cloud. The few people standing outside and nearest to the points of impact were instantly incinerated. They were the lucky ones. The shockwave produced by the explosion caused the first surge of destruction, producing thousands of pounds of pressure per square inch, enough to crush the hull of a World War II submarine. Those who weren't initially killed by the striking force of the overpressure waves suffered terribly. Limbs were torn away or broken. Alveoli and bronchioles ruptured in the lungs. Emboli formed in coronary and cerebral arteries. Bowels perforated. Inner ear structures were crushed. Eyes were ripped from their sockets. The crushing force of the expanding overpressure waves smashed walls, broke windows, shattered doors. The city itself became a form of shrapnel, hurling shards of burning brick, glass, wood, and iron through the fiery winds, lacerating soft tissues and exposed flesh. Yet this still wasn't the worst of it. The powdered aluminum in the expanding plasma cloud slowed its burn rate, resulting in the total consumption of the atmospheric oxygen. This created both a massive vacuum and a fireball of nearly 3,000 degrees Celsius, twice the melting point of steel. But it was the vacuum that caused the most destruction. The buildings and other structures still standing held no protections against the fast-forming negative pressure, equal to its opposite in energy and violence, generating fiery hurricane-force winds. Shrieking survivors were crushed beneath tons of crumbling debris, buried alive in basements, crucified on shattered timbers, impaled on twisted metal.
Anyone still alive in the rubble spent their last few minutes suffocating to death, gasping like carp for oxygen that no longer existed. There were no more laughing children in the streets. The last of the thermobaric munitions burned out just as the explosions of gas mains, petrol tanks, and other urban flammables began, stoking the burning rubble and the still living bodies beneath into an inferno of unquenchable fire. Within seconds, thousands had died, and thousands more suffered. Within a few hours, many of the wounded survivors would perish as well. It was the explosive equivalent of a tactical nuclear device, but entirely conventional and perfectly legal, according to international treaties. It was also hell on Earth. Chapter 3. The White House, Washington, D.C. Jack Ryan Jr. spooned up the last of the burgundy beef stew, earthy and rich, scraping the bowl as he fished out the last piece of savory meat. "More, son?" Dr. Kathy Ryan asked. "Always. But two helpings are enough," Jack Jr. said. This was his favorite meal, and his mother made it better than anybody. It was just Jack and his parents tonight. The twins were on an ecological field trip to the Virginia wetlands for the next 3 days, and his older sister was on ER duty at the hospital, so she couldn't join them. Jack and his parents were seated at the round table in the first family's private dining room, formerly known as the Prince of Wales guest room, before Jacqueline Kennedy converted it to its current function for her own young family. Kathy Ryan had redecorated it in a transitional craftsman style, favoring the clean lines and sturdy functionality of an original American art form. "I hope you saved room for the apple pie," she said, standing. "Are you kidding me?" Jack said. His mother's apple pie was his all-time favorite dessert. His suspicions grew. "What's the occasion?" "Does a mother need a special reason to cook for her son?" she said. "When a mother is as busy as you are, yes, she does need a special reason. I haven't had a chance to see you in forever, and you're off to Europe soon. I knew the only way I could get you over here was to bribe you with a home-cooked meal. Besides, it's something I love to do." She glanced at her husband, a pair of reading glasses perched on the end of his nose, his mind buried in a file folder on the dining room table. "Isn't that right, honey?" Senior grunted. "What?" "Yeah, dinner was great." Kathy fake frowned. "Hey, bub, what's more interesting than us?" Senior kept staring at the file. "I'd tell you, but you don't have the clearance." Kathy Ryan leaped out of her chair and plopped into her husband's lap, wrapping her arms around his neck. She leaned in close to his ear, whispering heavily, "We have ways of making you talk, Mr. President." Senior laughed, shut his file, and pulled off his glasses, wrapping his arms around his wife's slender waist. The two exchanged a glance. He whispered in her ear. She giggled and swatted him. A lot of years. A lot of love. They were as steady and solid as the stickly oak table they all sat around. Junior watched them canoodling like a pair of frisky teenagers. The most famous power couple in the world. His father was arguably the greatest president of his generation, exercising selfless leadership on behalf of the national interest through every crisis in a town notorious for ruthless, self-aggrandizing ambition. His mother was a brilliant physician in her own right and bore the responsibilities of being first lady with dignity and grace. She was his father's rock. But to Jack, they were just mom and dad. He felt like a little kid again, sitting around the familiar table, but in a good way. Hard as they worked, family always came first for them. Whatever strength or honor or virtue he possessed, Jack knew, he got it from these two. He envied them. He and Yuki had to put a hold on their budding romance. Their schedules and careers were both too demanding, and Skype just wasn't cutting it. It was becoming a painfully familiar pattern in his personal life. He already felt the void of Yuki's absence, brief though their affair had been. His mother and father were married by the time they were Jack's age. Hell, John Clark, the Eternal Warrior, was married and had been for many years, and one of his daughters was married to Ding. Even Jack's cousin Dom and Adara were together. Nobody on the campus seemed to suffer performance-wise by being in a stable relationship. So what was wrong with him? All three Ryans stood and cleared the table, hauling the dishes to the kitchen. Senior made a pot of decaf coffee while Kathy served up the pie, and Jack fetched the vanilla bean ice cream out of the freezer. It was a small kitchen, but perfectly adequate for the first family on the few occasions they cooked for themselves. With some of the finest chefs in the country available around the clock, and the two senior Ryans working more than full-time jobs, cooking at home was a rare luxury. 10 minutes later, Junior scraped up the last piece of Granny Smith apple from his plate and forked it into his mouth, savoring the sweet and tangy bite, just the way he remembered it. "I wish you'd shave that awful beard," his mother said. "I miss your face." "Just keeping it real," Jack said. He didn't tell her that he changed his looks just to keep people guessing. He was, after all, the son of these two famous people, and because they had worked hard to keep their kids out of the limelight, he wasn't nearly as well known as some might think. But he wasn't completely anonymous either, so he took the extra step every 6 months or so to comb his hair in another direction, or grow it out long, or let a beard or mustache do the camouflage work. Sometimes he even wore contacts to change the color of his eyes. After the last ragged op, he thought about going for the clean-cut look of a stockbroker, which he sort of was. But no facial hair made him feel a little exposed, even if it was sometimes safest to hide in plain sight. He decided to keep the beard, but trimmed it close. Senior's attention was buried back in his classified file folder. "Another piece of pie?" Kathy asked her son. "No, thanks. I'm stuffed." Junior smiled. "It was perfect. Thank you." He sipped the last of his coffee and set his cup down. "Well, I need to get going. Got a plane to catch tomorrow." "You're off to the former Yugoslavia, right?" Kathy asked. "London first, then to Ljubljana, Slovenia. I've heard it's beautiful over there. It's on the southern border of Austria, near the Adriatic coast. You get the Alps and the ocean for one low price. Send pictures for sure. I'm curious, though. What financial interest does Hendley Associates have over there?" Senior again glanced up over the glasses perched on his nose. His wife didn't know about the campus, the Black Side Special Ops team that Jack also served with. All she knew was that Jack was an analyst with the White Side financial firm Hendley Associates, which funded the campus special operations through its highly successful investments and fiduciary services. "There's a company over there that wants to offer an IPO on the NASDAQ, and they hired us to do the preliminary financials." "Sounds boring," Kathy said. "Numbers tell a story, if you know how to read them," Senior offered. He looked at Jack. "Financial analysis has its own particular rewards in that regard. And risks." Junior smiled at the double entendre. Jerry Hendley was in charge of the personnel decisions, and he didn't always inform the president when his son was deployed on a dangerous op. Neither did Jack. "The only risk in Slovenia, from what I hear, is eating too much cream cake." Jack's father smiled. "Good to know." He returned to his reading. Only a handful of people knew that it was the president's idea to create the firm, or that it was his friend, the former Senator Jerry Hendley, who ran both sides of the company. The campus was a private intelligence organization created to carry out black ops missions that regular government agencies couldn't or wouldn't do, serving at the president's discretion. In a perfect world, the campus shouldn't have to exist, but the dysfunctional swamp of unscrupulous self-interest known as Washington, D.C., was considerably less than perfect, even in the estimation of its slimiest inhabitants. In the president's mind, D.C. was one giant Hungarian cluster dance, with occasional interruptions of clarity and purpose. But only when the national interest was properly communicated to and understood by the preening peacocks on the hill So, I was wondering if you might do me a favor while you were over there, Kathy said.
Sure, name it.
Kathy stepped over to a chair in the corner where a brown leather folder was perched. She picked it up and carried it back to the table. She pulled out a file folder and set it down in front of Junior before sitting down herself.
I was cleaning out some of my old medical files from Johns Hopkins and came across this.
Jack opened the file dated 1992. Inside the stiff green cover was a picture of his mother, 26 years younger, in her white doctor's coat, holding in her arms a little girl with luminous blue eyes and blonde hair, grinning at the camera. Well, one blue eye. The other was heavily bandaged.
Her name is, or was, Aida Kuric. She was just 3 years old at the time, when they brought her to me for eye surgery for a shrapnel wound. It was during the war.
Which war? Jack asked. From what I remember reading, Yugoslavia had several after the breakup in 1991. Senior closed his file. Your mother is referring to the Bosnian Civil War, when Serbs, Croats, and Muslims fought one another for independence and survival. You know the term ethnic cleansing?
Jack nodded.
Sure. One group of people trying to exterminate another one.
Evil stuff.
Well, Bosnia is where the term was invented. Civil wars are the worst. It was the bloodiest conflict on European soil since World War II. Even worse than the Ukraine invasion a few years ago. By some estimates, 140,000 Yugoslavians perished because the UN and the Europeans dragged their feet. It took NATO airstrikes to finally end it.
If my two history wonks can spare a moment, I'd like to finish my story about Aida, if that's okay.
Sorry, both Jacks said.
Anyway, by some miracle I managed to save her eye and her vision. After the war, her parents took her back home to Bosnia, but they stopped writing to me shortly afterward.
Kathy began to tear up.
I've seen those blue eyes of hers in my dreams 1,000 times, and I can't tell you how many candles I've lit for her over the years. Sometimes when I stared into your sister Sally's eyes, I saw hers. I don't know why Aida had such an effect on me, but she did, and I finally had to let her go. But seeing this file again yesterday stirred something up in me, and I can't stop thinking about her.
Kathy opened up her leather folio again and produced a sealed envelope.
I was wondering if you had any spare time while you were over there, if you could find a way to get down to Sarajevo and look for her and give her this for me.
She handed it to Jack. Only Aida's name, written in his mother's graceful and meticulous hand, was on the otherwise blank envelope.
Did you try Googling her for an address? Jack asked.
Kathy shrugged.
Sure, but Kuric is a common name, and it wasn't very helpful. Facebook wasn't any better, or Twitter for that matter.
The FBI is the world's greatest detective agency, and you're married to the boss. Why not call them?
This is personal business. I'm not going to ask my husband to deploy public resources for my personal benefit.
Well, I'm not on the government payroll, so I'm happy to do it. I've always wanted to visit Sarajevo. I hear it's an amazing city with a lot of history.
Senior nodded.
Yeah, a lot of history, for sure. As President Derling's national security advisor, Senior had seen the photos and read the first-hand accounts of the atrocities on all sides when the wars broke out in 1991. He'd urged Derling into action, but the Europeans told the Americans to back off, promising to handle things on their end. 3 years later, a suicidal Japanese pilot slammed into the U.S. Capitol building during a joint session of Congress, killing hundreds, including President Derling, the justices of the Supreme Court, and many others. Soon followed by a new Middle East war breaking out. By then, there wasn't anything the newly sworn President Ryan could do about the Yugoslavia situation. Still, many had suffered and died needlessly, and Senior still felt guilty that the United States hadn't tried to stop it unilaterally when it first began.
Senior repeated himself, almost in a whisper. A lot of history.
Are you sure you don't mind, dear? Kathy asked her son.
I hate to be a bother.
It's not a bother at all, Mom. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Chapter 4. Hama, Syria. Lieutenant Jabrailov trailed Captain Walib as he circled the TOS-2 Starfire vehicle, parked in a courtyard next to the mosque, shielded from prying American eyes orbiting in space overhead by computer-designed camouflage netting. The netting broke up the searing sunlight pouring out of the sky as well, a welcome respite. The big Chechen stood a head taller than the slight Syrian. Both carried holstered pistols. Walib dismissed the three Russian enlisted men for lunch break while the two of them conducted a security inspection of the vehicle. "I've reviewed your proposal, Lieutenant." "And?" the Chechen asked. Walib knelt in the dust, checking one of the track plates on the tread. Or pretending to. "Your commander. He's reliable."
"As reliable as you."
Walib stood back up, facing Jabrailov.
"Meaning?"
The big Chechen glanced around. They were alone. He lowered his voice anyway and shrugged.
"Meaning, I haven't been put up against the wall and shot since we last spoke. So I trust you. And I assume that means you trust me. I'll vouch for my commander with my life."
Walib's eyes narrowed, taking the measure of the man again.
"You're vouching with both of our lives."
"Understood.
And there's no question in your mind we can pull it off. If there were, I wouldn't be standing here."
Jabrailov glanced around again.
"And you are certain you want to do this, then? There is no turning back from it."
Walib's face hardened. "As certain as anything I have ever known. I will die rather than turn back. Do you doubt me?"
The Chechen shook his head. "I trust your hate, brother, and the will of Allah."
"Then we'll speak no more about it. And I am still your captain, not your brother."
"Yes, sir. When do you propose to make the move?"
"The sooner the better," Walib said. He turned around and continued with his half-hearted inspection. "Before the next fire mission, 13 days from now."
"How about tonight?"
Walib whipped back around.
"Tonight? How is that even possible?"
Jabrailov allowed himself a small grin.
"Everything is already arranged."
"You are overly confident, Lieutenant. You couldn't have known what my answer would be. I didn't know it myself until an hour ago."
"I saw what happened to you at the launch, Captain."
Jabrailov darkened. "I saw the same thing in myself not so long ago." But the Chechen brightened just as quickly.
"And I also know, because Allah told me that this was his plan."
"You mean your commander's plan, don't you?"
"My commander is a servant of the Most High, as am I."
The Chechen smiled.
"As are you, Captain."
"Perhaps," Walib said,
"we'll know soon enough." "What do you propose for tonight, then, exactly?"
They spoke in measured whispers for the next 15 minutes, while they inspected the hulking tank chassis with its giant missile box affixed above, pretending to check for signs of damage or needed maintenance. Anyone watching them from a distance wouldn't have thought anything about them, or paid attention to the short salutes they returned to the grateful guards as they resumed their posts. The two conspirators parted ways, each in a different direction. Their determined steps quickened with the urgency of the damned. Presidency Building, Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The Turkish ambassador sipped a strong black Bosnian coffee from a cup of fine bone china. His smiling eyes gleamed behind steel-framed glasses above a sharp, distinctive nose and a thick but well-trimmed mustache tinged with gray, as was his hair, though he was nearly bald now. This gave Ambassador Topal a rather agreeable but owlish appearance, which suited his reputation as a patient and thoughtful diplomat. He sat across the desk from the Bosnian president, a Muslim, locally known as Bosniaks. In fact, the man was just one of three Bosnian presidents. If a camel was a horse designed by a committee, then the Bosnian presidency was a three-headed camel, a collective head of state. It was composed of three presidents, an ethnic Croat, an ethnic Serb, and a Bosniak. But such was the mystery and compromise that governed the enigma of this ethnically and culturally divided republic. At least the three presidential heads were of one mind. For now. Topal had accepted the modest posting to the small but troubled republic for a number of reasons, one of which was his fascination with its complicated politics and governance. Bosnia and Herzegovina, Bosnia for short, was a nation comprising two political entities, like states, the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, with primarily ethnic Croats and Muslims, and the Republika Srpska, with mainly ethnic Serbs. Bosnia was a creation of European design at the end of the Bosnian War to form a peaceful, liberal, democratic republic between these three distinct but hostile groups. So far the experiment had worked, after a fashion. Yet in the last few years, just about the time Topal accepted his ambassadorship, ethno-nationalist factions from each group began agitating for independence from one another. In recent months, small acts of insurgency had occurred across Bosnia, committed apparently by resurgent ethnic militias. Sloganeering graffiti sprayed on government buildings, smashed shop windows, burned cars. Fortunately, no people had been injured or killed by the hooliganism. At least, not yet. Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks were equally active on social media, airing current and historic grievances against one another while simultaneously claiming the moral high ground against the fanatics who oppressed them. Local and national politicians from all sides were beginning to pick up their respective ethno-nationalist flags in hopes of taking advantage of the increasing friction. This occurred even as the national police and security forces stepped up their efforts to find and prosecute domestic terror operations. The senior leadership of the national political parties, along with each of the three Bosnian presidents, the titular heads of their respective parties, came up with a unique plan to stem the rising tide last year. They ordered a national unity referendum to be held on the same day as the upcoming national elections, just 6 weeks away. The idea was to show that the vast majority of Bosnians, Orthodox Serbs, Catholic Croats, and Muslim Bosniaks all preferred to remain a single, unified democracy. The hope was that a successful referendum would curb the rising nationalist forces and, not coincidentally, assure the easy re-election of the incumbent parties that sponsored it. The initial announcement was greeted enthusiastically by liberal Democrats of all stripes and widely supported in the public opinion polls, especially among the business community. If Bosnia had any hope of entering the EU in the near future, it would have to demonstrate that it was a stable, functioning, and pluralist democracy. The religious leaders of all three faiths even signed a joint letter supporting the referendum, speaking in favor of continued national unity as a practical act of faith in God and in one another. But in the months that followed, opinion polls began turning in the opposite direction, particularly as local violence escalated. There was now a real chance that the unity referendum would fail. If it did, Bosnia would undoubtedly break up. What seemed like a painless, thoughtful solution last year had become both a social and political crisis of the first order today. This explained why the Bosniak president sitting in front of him was so animated this afternoon, Topal thought. The magnificent Ali Pasha Mosque loomed in the bright fall sun in the large window behind the president's desk. "I don't care what they say. This isn't an act of religious renewal," the president said. He was referring to the recently announced Serbian Orthodox renewal liturgy. The president's round, clean-shaven face reddened with each word. "It's a political act, pure and simple, meant to derail the unity referendum." "And Ivanovich, the Serb president of Bosnia, knows this. And yet he chooses to attend. What is he thinking?" Topal set his cup and saucer down on the small table in front of him. "What choice does President Ivanovich have? The bishop is his bishop, and his Orthodox citizens vote. If he steps away from the renewal, it looks like he's the one playing politics. Besides, none of us thought this was a problem 2 weeks ago. I don't blame President Ivanovich. I think other forces are at play. As do I. And we both know who. The Serbian Orthodox Renewal Service was just weeks away, when it was originally announced by Sarajevo's bishop for the local metropolitanate as an outdoor baptismal service and liturgy at Sarajevo's Olympic soccer stadium. It was assumed that no more than several hundred, or perhaps a few thousand at most, would participate. Like most Europeans, the average Bosnian, Serb or otherwise, was usually more passionate about his local soccer team than the practice of his religion. But with the announcement by the Patriarch of the Serbian Orthodox Church, a Serbian national from the nation of Serbia, not the Republika Srpska within Bosnia, interest began to grow. But it was the announcement by the Patriarch of Moscow, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, that he would also be attending that kindled a fire of apparent faith renewal. The latest estimate was that 30,000 Orthodox Serbs from around the region now planned to fill the stadium, many from across the Serbian border. "There is no question in my mind that this is stoking Serb nationalism," the president said. "And if Serbs galvanize, so will the Catholic Croats, not to mention my own people." Topal shook his head. "A democracy cannot survive identity politics. Bosnians must think of themselves as Bosnian, first and always. All religions are respected in your country, and everybody has equal rights, and there has been peace. But all of that is at risk if ethnic identity trumps democratic ideals." The president leaned back in his chair, tenting his fingers. "If Bosnia breaks apart, there will be trouble again, like in the old days." His round face darkened, overwhelmed with painful memories of the genocidal war. "My country stands with you, Mr. President, and with all Bosnians, especially our Muslim brothers and sisters. I believe we have demonstrated our commitment to you and your democracy." Topal was politic enough not to mention the hundreds of millions of Turkish liras his government had poured into Bosnia over the past decade, much of it under Topal's guidance. "Turkey is our best friend, and we are grateful for your continued commitment. Both of our governments understand the existential crisis that a failed Bosnian democracy represents. The nationalisms here will only spread, and regional instability will be the inevitable result. If Croats and Bosniaks feel threatened, other nations, even NATO, might intervene against the Serbs to prevent another genocide." Topal sighed. "Yes, and if the Serbs are threatened, the Russians will intervene on behalf of their Slavic brethren to make up for their failure to protect Serbia from NATO during the Yugoslav wars." "NATO versus Russia again?" The president sighed. "We're speaking of World War III. "That would be a disaster, which is why my government stands ready to serve you and the unity referendum in any way possible." Topal leaned forward, smiling. "Be encouraged, my friend. Bosnia isn't dead yet. I have confidence that the forces of democracy will prevail. And who knows? Perhaps the renewal service will lead to something positive. A renewal of faith can be a good thing." "Given the history of my country, I'm not as sanguine as you are. But I thank you for your assurances and your friendship." The president stood, as did Topal. They shook hands. The Turkish ambassador caught a glimpse in the window of a flock of red-winged birds circling the tall minaret in synchronous flight. He smiled to himself. A good omen indeed. Chapter 5. Hama, Syria. Gretschko's heavy boot crushed the throttle of the tiny UAZ Jeep, its poorly maintained suspension bouncing him around in his seat like a bean inside a Cuban maraca. The UAZ was throwing dust and granite chips in a rooster tail behind him,
slewing around the snaking curves of the quarry road as fast as the straining four-cylinder engine would allow. He cursed violently, clutching gears in the sharp, spiraling turns, his headlights splashing across the twisting maze of steep quarry walls as he raced toward the bottom of the pit. His boot smashed the brake and the jeep skidded to a tooth-rattling halt in front of the heavy steel doors of the ammo warehouse, cut deep into the thick walls of granite. It was a highly unusual location to store munitions, and therefore not on American or Israeli aerial targeting lists, and well hidden from overhead surveillance. The steel-reinforced concrete walls were doubly protected beneath several hundred tons of quarry stone, creating a virtually impenetrable shield for the explosive contents inside. Gretschko leaped out of the jeep in a cloud of dust and stormed past the big covered 6x6 Kamaz cargo truck parked to the side. The jeep's headlights illumined dark blood spatter on one of the half-opened steel doors, confirming his worst fears. Walib's phone call had interrupted his evening with his favorite talented contract whore, a red-headed Ukrainian girl with high cheekbones and low self-esteem. But the captain's panicked voice quelled Gretschko's rage and convinced him that the Syrian was out of his depth, and a firm Russian hand was needed to take charge. Gretschko's eyes adjusted to the dim lights inside the warehouse. A long trail of blood and dust led from the doorway to Walib, who was kneeling down next to a body splayed out on the floor. Gretschko knelt down beside the body as well, examining the young face. One of the Russian guards, a corporal. Gretschko couldn't recall his name. The slit across the dead boy's throat was a wide, bloody smile beneath his clean-shaven chin. "What the hell happened here, Captain?" "This one dead, along with the other two farther back." Walib stood as Gretschko laid a soft hand on the young corporal's unblinking eyes and closed them. Gretschko sprang to his feet, his back to Walib. "We'll get the bastards who did this." He suddenly noticed that dozens of crates of 122mm missiles were gone from the far wall. He pointed at the empty spaces. The rest of the facility was stacked high with crates of 220mm thermobaric missiles needed for the TOS-1A Sunfire system still operating in-country.
"Walib, the 122s!
"Yes, I know.
They're gone.
One of the Schmelz, too," Walib said, referring to the RPOA Bumblebee, a thermobaric shoulder-fired rocket.
"Start an inventory immediately. I'll call security."
Gretschko spun back around, reaching for his cell phone. Walib's pistol was pointed at him.
"No need. I know exactly how many missiles were taken."
Gretschko's eyes widened with fury.
"You traitorous shit."
Walib crashed the butt of his pistol in the center of Gretschko's wide forehead, breaking the skin. Blood gouted from the wound. The Russian staggered under the blow but didn't fall. He wiped the blood out of his eyes with the back of his hairy hand, stunned and incredulous. His mind cleared, and he lunged with a shout at Walib's throat with his thick fingers. But the Syrian was ready for him, hammering the top of the major's skull again with the pistol's steel butt. Gretschko moaned as his knees buckled, and his head hit the concrete with a sickening thud, like a ripe melon dropped on a hot summer sidewalk. Walib holstered his pistol.
"Why didn't you just shoot him?" Jabrailov asked from the doorway.
Walib called over his shoulder, still staring at Gretschko.
"In here? You want to meet your virgins with your manhood cooked and your face fried like a falafel?"
The Chechen grinned. "We need to move." Walib spat on the Russian.
"One last thing, Lieutenant. Then we can go."
Jabrailov was driving the heavy truck west on a two-lane ribbon of asphalt when the moonless sky behind them erupted in a flash of blinding light. Walib sat in the cab riding shotgun. He checked his watch. The timer had worked perfectly. He imagined the bunker's thick steel doors melting like butter beneath the withering torch of the white-hot gases, and the explosive flames exhausting harmlessly through the quarry, scorching acres of nothing but granite and dust, without a single civilian casualty. Not only had Walib destroyed the rest of the thermobaric arsenal, he had also found a way to cover their tracks. There would be nothing left of the corpses, not even ash, or any hint that the crates of missiles they carried in the truck had been stolen. All of the missing personnel, the Russian guards, Grechko, Jabrailov, and him, would be presumed killed in an attack by Israeli Sayaret Matkal or Iranian Quds Force commandos. The Russians wouldn't allow the possibility of an accident. For the first time in a long time, Walib was happy. Killing Grechko with his own hands had done that. That surprised him. He was an artillery officer, not an infantryman. He'd never killed in anger before, or at close distance. Before tonight, he wasn't sure if he could do it. But it had been shockingly easy to kill the raging bastard, and satisfying to force the guards at gunpoint to load the heavy missile crates before Jabrailov's vicious blade dropped them like slaughtered lambs. Walib felt no guilt about them either. Revenge had a sweetness he hadn't expected. And tonight was only the beginning. He smiled. "Something funny, brother," Jabrailov asked. "The Russians will probably award us medals of valor for our glorious sacrifice." "A medal would be nice," the Chechen joked. "Too bad we can't collect it." "Neither can Grechko." The thought of the Russian's head cracking on the concrete made Walib smile again. Perhaps Jabrailov was right after all. Perhaps they really were doing the will of Allah. Walib had never known a plan to survive first contact with the enemy. That alone was a miracle. All of the pieces were in play now. So long as the checkpoint guards up ahead had been bribed as promised, they'd be home free. The foreign Chechen, the violent and unlikely ally, had proven as good as his word so far. Walib looked forward to meeting this mysterious commander of Jabrailov's when the real work began. Walib was, no doubt, a changed man now. A man on a mission. But did that make him a mujahid? Walib checked his watch again. They were even ahead of schedule. "We'll make the coast before sunrise." "Inshallah," the Chechen said. Walib patted the heavy black pelican case between them, an object of even greater importance than the other device they had stolen, or even the ordnance stacked in the covered bed behind them. "Yes, indeed. Inshallah." Chapter 6. Atopol, Bulgaria. It was a modest house with a priceless view, high on the ridge of a finger of land thrusting into the Black Sea. Vladimir Vasilev owned many more houses far grander and with even more magnificent views all over Europe, but Bulgaria was home, and he had wanted to die here. Each morning, Vasilev woke to a shimmering sunrise above a wine-dark sea, the light pouring through his plate-glass window. The dawn was not so much a promise of the day to come as it was a sparkling reminder that he had managed to survive one more fearful night, another day to realize his last and final wish. The short Ghanaian contract nurse changed his catheter with practiced economy, neither smiling nor frowning as she completed the intimate task. Her large breasts strained against her tight-fitting green scrubs, which were barely able to contain her enormous posterior. Exactly the kind of woman Vasilev favored. Even just a year ago, he would have taken her with a seduction of Ocetrus sturgeon caviar and a fine champagne on his yacht. Or, if she resisted his charms, raped her as she wept. But he felt no stirring in his loins this morning, despite her gloved hands fingering his flaccid manhood. She finished her work, removed her gloves, and cleansed her hands with antiseptic gel before asking him if he needed anything else in nervous, lilting English. Vasilev shook his enormous head, his withered jowls stubbled with white. His flesh was pale gray and mottled brown with moles, like a mushroom cap. He had no appetite, only an unquenchable thirst from the cannula constantly blowing oxygen into his nose. Drinking fluids directly nearly drowned him. He could only soothe his parched throat with ice chips from the large cup on the table beside him.
Is he here yet? The nurse nodded. He arrived 15 minutes ago. I thought you would prefer for him to wait until... Send him in now.
He was paying her too much to be polite.
Of course.
Vasilev elevated his bed with a remote control as his number two appeared. A tall Czech, Sudeten German from the Ure Mountains, in fact, with brittle, yellowed skin like old parchment. The lifelong smoker was only 5 years younger than Vasilev, and despite his cadaverous appearance, healthy as an ox. Never a day in hospital in all the years Vasilev had known him. The Czech took the chair near the bed, removing his felted green Tyrolean hat.
Vladimir, how are you feeling this morning, my old friend?
I dreamed last night my body was full of crabs, clawing out my guts with their giant red pincers.
The Czech shook his head, frowning.
My wife died from cancer. I know how painful it must be. Drink a bottle of battery acid and then shit out a box of roofing nails, and then you might have a glimmer of an idea of how painful it is.
I'm so sorry.
No, you're not. You're relieved it isn't you in this bed and me sitting in that chair.
Vasilev winced with a sudden stab of pain. He jabbed the morphine button in his hand, dosing himself again. It was having less and less effect. When the pain finally eased, he asked,
What news for me regarding Rhodes?
The Czech's eyes dropped for a moment, thoughtfully fingering the red speckled feather tucked in the hatband.
Not a good sign, Vasilev knew.
Still no luck, I'm afraid.
Luck? Luck has nothing to do with it. How hard can it be to kill a man trapped in a prison cell?
An American prison cell, the Czech protested. A federal one at that. And he is a former senator, so he is closely watched.
You don't need more luck, Vasilev said. You need more money. Increase the bounty. Make it $5 million.
That's a lot of cash.
I haven't much patience. I'm flying to the Paris clinic tomorrow.
Then $5 million it is.
The Czech raised an eyebrow.
How long will you be gone?
2 months at least. But what choice do I have?
It's a smart move. And it's Paris.
Bah, Vasilev said, waving a veiny hand. It's a medical facility in the suburbs, trapped in a quarantined cage with no guarantees of success.
Still, my doctor says without this new experimental treatment, I would be fortunate to last another 6 months.
The old Bulgarian winked.
He nearly pissed his pants telling me that, so I suspect it would have been less.
You'll make out just fine. I read up on this CAR-T treatment. It's the very latest Western medicine has to offer.
The Czech's investigation caused him both despair and hope. Despair because the revolutionary treatment had proven wildly effective in pediatric blood cancer trials. The treatment removed a patient's natural cancer-fighting T-cells and genetically altered millions more into little homing missiles targeting the specific cancer when reintroduced into the body. Vasilev stood an excellent chance, theoretically. That meant more years of the old killer's tyrannical rule, and he himself was not getting any younger. The Czech's only hope was that other clinical trials for solid adult tumor treatments such as Vasilev required had been mixed. There was an even chance that the Bulgarian butcher wouldn't survive after all. Vasilev's kill list madness would end, and the Czech's ascendancy could begin.
For the $500,000 a month it's costing me, I should be more than fine, Vasilev said, wheezing with effort.
He grinned mischievously.
With this miracle treatment, maybe I'll live forever. Nothing would please me more.
The Czech shuddered inwardly, but hid his disdain with a smile. Vasilev's fixation on the kill list bordered on insanity. It had cost the Iron Syndicate millions, the loss of several vital assets, and unnecessary attention from state authorities.